You are listening to Extinction Radio. Get the podcast at extinctionradio.org.
It's our privilege today to welcome Peter Wadhams to Extinction Radio. Peter is Professor of Ocean Physics and Head of the Polar Ocean Physics Group in the Department of Applied Mathematics and Theoretical Physics at the University of Cambridge. He's also President of the International Association for the Physical Sciences of the Oceans Commission on Sea Ice and Coordinator for the International Programme for Antarctic Buoys. Peter has been a leader of 50 polar field expeditions. Tomorrow, Peter's new book, Farewell to Ice, will be on the bookshelves around the world, I should imagine. So go out there and buy your copy. I've got mine on order already, and I can't wait to read it. So welcome to the show, Peter Wadhams.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
That's our pleasure to have you, Peter. But what we'd like to do first is ask you to maybe to give us a little summary of the contents of your new book.
Fine. Yes. Well, I wrote the book because I was really concerned about the way in which Arctic climate change, or the way in which the change in the Arctic, especially the retreat of sea ice, is accelerating climate change globally through a lot of feedback mechanisms which are often not considered adequately by the bodies which are supposed to be alert to all this, like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and that if you add together all the feedbacks which are occurring related to the retreat of the ice, then we're having something going on which is accelerating global warming by quite a large factor. So that was my big concern, was that, and the various things that might be happening as a result of that, which including large-scale releases of methane from the coastal shelves. But I also wanted to then go on to generally consider what can we do about climate change globally, given that it's actually happening faster than we think. And my ultimate conclusion there is that really we can only solve the problem by finding ways of taking direct air capture, taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, because there's too much already in the atmosphere and we can't rely on reducing emissions. That's just not going to help us to actually keep warming within limits that are not disastrous. And even geoengineering, which I think is also a good thing to try, will only put a sticking plaster on global warming. It won't actually stop it, because the carbon dioxide increase continues, the ocean continues to get acidified. So that was my basis. It was a kind of a hope that all of these things can be discussed more and people will be more aware of just what kind of threat we face. But also the title has another meaning, in that, because I pinched it from Ernest Hemingway, but the other meaning is that there's some personal stuff in there which describes my own feelings as I went through sort of 45 years of sea ice research, at what I feel about the fact that the ice is now disappearing from the Arctic.
Right. That's a really good summary, and I think that will add to the interest of the book, as well as the factual information, which will no doubt be quite comprehensive, to get a personal take on how it is for you to say farewell to the ice yourself. Yeah. Because
yes.
Are you retiring anytime soon?
Well, I'm actually I've just retired from Cambridge University as under their completely illegal retirement age rule of 67, which is against the law in Britain, but which Cambridge and Oxford universities managed to get a let out clause so they could get rid of people just when they're at the very height of their powers. So I'm very annoyed at that.
Right. So was it your choice to retire?
No, we're not given a choice. It's illegal to force people to retire, but Cambridge and Oxford have got themselves a let out, which itself is illegal. So somebody has to challenge this. But in fact, I was forced to retire. And so now I'm actually doing my research, continuing my research, because I retired with a lot of research grants. So the university was shooting itself in the foot by making me retire. So I'm transferring them all to a university in Italy, and I'm continuing my career.
Brilliant.
There.
Absolutely brilliant. I mean, not brilliant in terms of Cambridge University and the legality, but brilliant that you're continuing, Peter, because you would be very sadly missed at this very important juncture in our history. And I just want to mention the book again. It's called Farewell to Ice. Everybody go out and buy that. We've got a number of questions here, Peter, from people in the NTHE support group, and I think these will challenge you in some ways, and may actually repeat some of the things that you've just said. But Andrew Beck has said that he would be interested to hear your opinion on whether cloud seeding and fine mists in the Arctic, or building mountains in low-lying desert areas to create precipitation, isn't just shifting the problem somewhere else? And is there a joined-up holistic view of the impacts of geoengineering yet, or is it still mostly about specific site fixes?
I think the two big types of geoengineering methods that are being advocated, which one of which is adding stratospheric aerosols, sulfate aerosols, for instance, and the other, which is marine cloud brightening. They both have problems, but I think the one that I would advocate, and which I advocate in my book, is marine cloud brightening, because first of all, you have to gain public acceptance for geoengineering, and I can see vast suspicions arising in the public if you try and do something like putting sulfate aerosols in the stratosphere. People are going to start complaining if their climate in their country gets worse.
Exactly. Yeah.
And also that the atmosphere is being poisoned by these things. Yeah. That's another fear. But in fact, marine cloud brightening just consists of injecting tiny particles of a vapor. It's sort of water vapor, but it's tiny water particles into the bottom of stratus clouds, which are the clouds that make Britain such a dismal place, and brightening them up. And the at least the calculation, first of all, it was a method that was invented in Britain. So if Britain wants to make a real contribution to dealing with global change, there's something that's an all-British method. It was invented by John Latham, who was at the University of Leeds, but is now part of the time in the US. And the method of doing it and all the technology of how to inject the water was developed by Stephen Salter, who's a brilliant marine engineer.
Edinburgh.
And
where I'm speaking from.
Oh, that's wonderful. And he invented, because one of the first practical wave power machines, until the government stopped supporting that research just when he was on the verge of success. But now he's come up with a method of injecting the water vapor, and also doing it from unmanned ships that will sail around the ocean, controlled by Fletner rotors, so that they're computer controlled. They sail around and do this job. He reckons you need about 100 to 200 of them, and that will be enough to actually hold back global warming completely. And I think he's right. And the modelling that's been done on this really suggests that it's going to be a global effect. And so it's not going to be focused on a particular place, although you can focus it regionally if you cluster together the ships in one particular place. For instance, you can try to cool the Arctic enough to bring the sea ice back. And to some extent, you can do that by focusing where you put the ships. But the reason it first of all it should work, and secondly it's harmless, because if it's not working or if you're getting an effect you don't particularly want, you just stop doing it, and you haven't put anything of lasting poisonous effect into the atmosphere.
Right, a very comprehensive answer, and I presume you'll be continuing this kind of research and continuing the development of Salter's ships or whatever they are, machines, in Italy, yeah?
Well, the hope is that it will be funded in Britain, because with colleagues, with Salter and other colleagues, we've got a bid in to say, well, look, here's a way Britain can make a difference in climate change, and the research, if we can do the research and bring it to fruition and actually start deploying these systems, which Salter thinks is quite possible quite quickly, then we can actually get something done. And so that would be done in Britain, because that's where my colleagues are.
Right, well, you might have some new colleagues in Italy soon as well, you know. On to a second question from, we have a number of questions from Gail Zawacki. She says, it has been alleged that climate scientists have been pressured to refrain from presenting their more alarming research findings by other colleagues or supervisors, and that they self-censor rather than be criticized for results that might be seen as extreme. Do you think this has happened? And if so, are there any specific examples you are prepared to share with us?
Well, yes, it has happened. And in fact, I do deal with that in the book, and I do quote specific examples in the book. So
right.
I'm probably going to get into trouble for that. But it's a depressing thing that I find that about 30 years ago, when we were doing the first measurements that were showing change going on, and that was working from submarines, I was measuring ice thickness across the Arctic Ocean and finding that the average thickness was going down. And this was the first evidence that the ice is getting thinner as well as shrinking. So at that time, you published your research results and their observations, so they're true, and everybody accepted that. And in those days when curiously enough, Margaret Thatcher was very, very keen on doing
Yes, I heard that and was surprised at that for some reason, but why shouldn't she, I suppose?
Well, she was very good at, well, in that area anyway. She understood the whole phenomenon quite quickly, because she was trained as a chemist, and she founded the Hadley Centre for Climate Change Research. She was really pushing strongly for international agreements on doing something about reducing carbon emissions. But this all happened towards the end of her reign, and so she was kind of pushed out for other reasons. But if she'd have stayed, she would have been able to accomplish something quite significant on climate change, and no other British politician since then has really done anything much. In fact, a lot of them haven't had a clue, and they certainly haven't taken any serious action the way that she was doing.
It's really interesting to actually have one positive thing to say about Margaret Thatcher in my eyes anyway. If I could go on to another question. Donna Yost asks if you're ever concerned for your safety, considering the alarming news that you have.
I think she's perhaps drawing attention to this skewering I got from a sleazeball Times reporter who.
Yes, she is.
Yes. That was a case where I just drew his attention to the sort of coincidence that the three other people who were working on sea ice thickness all died within 3 months of one another in curious accidents, and I was forced off the road by what I thought and still think to have been a deliberate attempt to kill me. So when I was talking to the reporter, I said, "No, this is not to be used," because I knew I'd be absolutely slaughtered for that, for actually saying that. And of course, he used it because he was doing his master's will, master being Murdoch. But I'm not really scared for my own safety now, because I don't think, firstly, that I'm that important. Secondly, my book's published now, and
yes, it's out there.
And thirdly, if there was a threat, the fact this has come out in the press in a way makes me safer than I was before.
Yes, I think that's right. We'll go on to another question from Gail Zawacki, and she says, "Can you talk about the shutdown of the, which you probably do in your book, of thermohaline circulation? How likely and how soon do you think this might occur with AMOC, and what effects would you anticipate in Europe or other regions?" This is obviously dependent on your belief in certain aspects of geoengineering, but assuming that geoengineering didn't work, what do you believe about that? Assuming geoengineering wasn't put into place, what would happen?
Well, I have a chapter on this in the book, because I've worked on the thermohaline circulation, doing measurements of chimneys in the Greenland Sea, which is the way in which the water sinks in the northern North Atlantic and keeps the thermohaline circulation going. Now, what's happened in the last few years is that the ice has stopped forming in that region, and that prevents the sinking from happening, because in the past, as ice formed in the winter, the salt from the formation of ice went back into the sea, made the seawater more dense and produced sinking in these chimneys, which are very remarkable features, like 20 kilometer diameter cylinders sinking into the ocean.
Right.
Now, that stopped happening, and that really means that the thermohaline circulation is slowing down, because you're not getting the sinking that completes. It's the sinking part of the conveyor belt that's being prevented. So there'll still be heat transported in the Atlantic from the tropics to northern Europe, because of the Gulf Stream, which is mainly wind-driven, but the underlying thermohaline part of it is slowing down. So there's been some modelling done of this, assuming that this slowing down continues. By the end of the century, it will affect the warming of Europe in a way which actually favours Britain, that Britain and the Atlantic seaboard of Europe, Ireland, Norway, Western France, will get about 2 degrees of warming. This is business as usual, that if you don't do anything about climate change, you'll get about 2 degrees of warming on the Atlantic seaboard, but 4 degrees of warming in the interior of Europe. So the prediction for business as usual European warming by the end of the century is very serious. 4 degrees would be enough to turn Italy into the same as North Africa is today, for instance. But Britain will be saved from that, really, by the fact that the ocean, that the Atlantic Ocean is cooling because of less heat being transported from the tropical Atlantic to the northern Atlantic. Of course, that means the tropical Atlantic warms faster, so there'll be much more intense hurricanes down there. There isn't any loss of heat. It's just the heat is now focused more in the tropical Atlantic and less in the northern Atlantic.
Right. You mentioned at the end of the century that there's certainly quite a body of increasing numbers of people who believe that we're in the next few decades. Things are going to turn extremely chaotic, and the actual temperature is going to be rising in an exponential or an abrupt fashion, and we could get to 2, 3, 4 degrees within a couple of decades. Mm. What's your take on that? Do you think that's nonsense?
No, I think that's possible. It's it's something that is focused on a lot by James Hansen, who is obviously a very highly respected figure. And he's concerned both with the warming rate increasing exponentially and also with the rate of sea level rise increasing exponentially, because we're now getting an increasing rate of melt from the Greenland ice sheet and the beginning of melt from the Antarctic ice sheet. And that means that the rate of sea level rise is going up. And he just wants to draw attention to the fact that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change always assumes linear change because it's very conservative. But in practice, we're going to get exponential change, and exponential changes start off looking kind of benign, but after you've gone through a few years of an exponentially increasing change, it stops being benign and it starts accelerating out of control, and before you can do anything about anything, things are falling apart all over the
climate. So, I mean, your idea would be to get geoengineering up and running as quickly as possible.
Yes, you must get things up and running while things still look okay, so as to avoid that accelerating phase when we can't do anything about it. The thing that I think is very harmful, which Hansen draws attention to, is this attitude that the jury's still out on climate change. This is a lie, of course, but it's something. Politicians, the jury's still out on climate change, so why don't we wait and see what happens, and then if it really looks as if climate is warming rapidly, then we do something. Because what he says is, well, if we wait until things start speeding up and looking obvious that it's happening, it's too late then to do anything.
I mean, your geoengineering proposals, do you honestly believe that there is a political will to actually go ahead and do this?
Not in Britain. I hoped there was, but we've been talking actually with government scientists, government people recently, and we don't see much enthusiasm. I think having signed the Paris Agreement, Britain sort of feels that's enough. We've set a target, we've signed an agreement, we don't actually have to do anything much. But I think the effort, if it's made, is much more likely to come from the United States, because if they recognise that there's a real problem, they've got a kind of can-do mentality. So it takes a long time to persuade them that there's a problem, but once they recognize that, they'll go flat out and solve it, because they're good at doing that sort of thing.
Right, but how bad do you think things are going to have to get in America, because Louisiana has just been subject to floods, as you'll know. How bad do you think things are going to have to get in America before they actually realize that the shit has hit the American fan?
Well, I think it's being recognised. I mean, for instance, my book, I was visiting America earlier this month, and I find huge numbers of people want to buy it, and have been, in fact, they can't get hold of it because there aren't enough copies being sent to America. And one of the reasons is this flooding problem. Another one is the fact that you're seeing overt evidence of global change everywhere, especially in places where decisions are made. For instance, in California, you've got this long-lasting drought, extreme heat, brush fires, forest fires. You've got, of course, the flooding of New Orleans, but you're also getting sea level rise affecting Miami and other cities which are down at sea level, have very expensive real estate that will all be flooded.
Yeah,
they're beginning to and changing in crop production in the Midwest as well, which is ascribed to, I'm not absolutely sure it's due to that, but it's ascribed to this deviations in the jet stream, which are associated with the retreat of sea ice in the Arctic. So in America, it's such a big, it's a continent-sized country, that the global effects of sea ice, of climate change, are happening and are recognised.
So I'm presuming that you think that Clinton will get in. Do you think Clinton will get in? Because
I hope so, yes.
She hopes. Well, Bernie's certainly not going to get in. So do you think that she has any real take on climate change?
Well, not. I don't think she's particularly inspiring on it, but she is positive, at least. Whereas Trump, one doesn't know what he thinks about climate change or anything.
Yeah. Okay. We'll go to another question. Another one from Gail Zawacki. Maybe calm us down a little bit. On a personal level, can you describe one or two moments in your very exciting career, which is not over, I'm pleased to say, as an explorer that really stand out in your memory as being quite a thrill?
Well, a thrill depends what you mean. A terrifying thrill was when I nearly got killed in a submarine accident.
Oh.
So I talk about that in the book. It was 2007. I was in the Arctic in a submarine, the Tyrus, and we were under the ice doing a survey of ice thickness near and under an ice camp that the Americans had built. And we found suddenly there was an explosion, and this brown smoke ran straight through the submarine. And what had happened was an oxygen generator had blown up and killed a couple of the crew, and their crew's their bodies fell against the hatch and blocked the hatch, and it started a fire. So you had fire in a submarine under ice, which is about the worst possible combination you could get.
Yeah.
They had to flood that compartment, eventually managed to get up through the ice and open up, and everybody was able to get out. But for quite a while, about 3 hours, trying to get out. And initially, nobody knew what had happened. And so I assumed that I was going to be dead in a few seconds, because if you're in a submarine and you have a big explosion, you don't, obviously something's wrong. And it was actually a faulty oxygen generators that had been returned by the submarine to the naval base, and then the naval base had sent them out again and said use them anyway, which was really a pretty shameful thing. And it was covered in a public inquiry, which did produce a report, but it was pretty scary at the time. And
Jeez, I mean, I admire your bravery. I would not do what you have done. Over the past, how many years has it been you've been involved in this?
47 years.
That's a small matter of time, 47 years. I would not do that. But surely there have been many thrills and many beautiful moments that you've had just being amongst the ice and the sunsets. And have you had a lot of that?
Oh, well, yes. I mean, one really wonderful experience was going dog sledging with the Eskimos of Northwest Greenland. That's at Karnak, which is the name for Thule. And in the winter, the village is completely surrounded by sea ice, and there's icebergs in the bay, but they're actually ground. They're floating, but they're stuck in the sea ice. So we wanted to go out and look at those and measure them. So we went out a couple of days running with dog. There's two Eskimo hunters who use dog teams and they live off hunting, whereas most of the people in the village don't. But it was really wonderful to be able to go around with this dog team, because you have this wonderful experience of being behind about a dozen dogs that are in line abreast and dumping stuff on the ice as you go along. So you see the carbon dioxide emissions occurring there.
I'm going to give you a little kind of poem that somebody's sort of written, which leads me on to a question. He says, there's gas in the tank, but whom shall we thank? The butcher, the baker, the emissions maker? How do we live and have our being? Are we lost or found or fleeing? Found for what, by whom, and why? Is there life and love beyond the sky? Now, that makes me want to ask you the question, do you have any spiritual beliefs at all, Peter? And do you have any way of relaxing, say meditation, or do you believe in life after death, or what do you feel about all of that?
Well, I suppose these are kind of pretty personal beliefs, but I do. The answer to several of those questions is yes, I do believe in life after death, and if we're thinking about going back to climate change, you find one of the best books, introductory books on climate change, was written by Sir John Houghton, and he gives a whole chapter over to the spiritual aspects of climate change, and that we are in fact stewards of this planet. We're not meant to despoil it and leave a mess at the end. We must pass it on to the next generation.
Do you remember the name of the book?
Yes, it was called Climate Change, A Complete Briefing. It's by Sir John Houghton, and it's Cambridge University Press. It's a paperback and not very expensive, but very, very good. It's the one I recommend to all my students. The chapter there on the spiritual aspects of global change and why there's a moral reason why we should be doing something about it and not actually making the planet uninhabitable. It's something that I think is very powerful.
Right. Thank you for that, Peter. Mike Scholdice asks, Dr. Wadhams, he says, Dr. Wadhams, thank you for the life you spent studying the ice in the Arctic, which I presume you're probably still going to do, but thanks for the years that you've spent. He says, first of all, I assume it is a rather thankless job. Given its rather important function in giving our species one of the key factors in a stable climate and all. So he's just saying thanks. But then he goes on to say, what is your favourite snack?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer.
It is, isn't it?
Yes.
Give us a few if you like.
Well, because my wife's Italian,
okay.
I suppose things we really like that are special to the small town where we live when we're in Italy. There's a sort of thing that's a kind of stuffed olive. It's a thing stuffed with shredded olives, and I forget the name of it, but it's characteristic of this town called Fermo, which is in the Marche, and you have to go there to eat them.
it sounds absolutely disgusting to me. I've never even gone as far as tasting an olive, because I don't know if you've got that with some kind of foods. You look at it and you think, no, I'm not going to like that. And I've never eaten an olive, so I shouldn't really be making presumptions about olives, but if that's your favourite snack.
Well, it's one of them.
That's one of them. We'll move on. I want to get this question from Gail Zawaki. In an interview on YouTube last year, you described the Pope's encyclical as a glimmer of hope to encourage action on climate change. No, it's not encyclical, is it?
Encyclical.
Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you say to the critique that climate change is only one symptom of human overshoot? And without a global consensus to reduce both population and consumption and mitigation such as geoengineering, global warming won't make a dent in the sixth mass extinction that biologists are documenting?
Well, I think that's right. And I think the encyclical was a really big step forward, because there hadn't been a specific concentration by previous popes on this, and I was sort of involved because it emerged from a meeting which was held by the Pontifical Academy of Sciences at the Vatican, and I was one of the speakers there.
Right.
But he doesn't mention population control, And obviously, because of the particular Catholic doctrine on that, and which I think was a real shame, because it's true that if we're thinking about what's going to do us in, or one of the things that makes it most difficult to deal with climate change is the increasing numbers of people on the planet, each of them busy producing carbon dioxide. And one of the worst aspects of that, which I deal with in my book, is that firstly, climate change gives you a reduction in food production because of this these extreme weather events that are happening. So there's a threat to world food production just at a time when the world population is growing fast. And the places it's growing fastest are the places where there's the least possibility of improving food supplies, and that's Africa. And the United Nations predictions for African population by the end of the century is that it's quadruple what it is now. It's a frightening prediction. Every other part of the world is showing some percentage, a few tens of percent increase. But Africa is four times as many people, and yet it's a continent where there's nothing much that can be done to improve food production. And in fact, it's going to decrease because with global warming, the edge of the Sahara will move southwards. So it means the whole of the rest of the planet will have to support Africa. And given one hopes human beings are going to be morally bound, feel morally bound to do that. But of course, they might not. They might just leave Africa in the lurch, and then you'd have enormous famines.
Right. And there's also the North Africa, the encroaching there, and the big droughts there in Syria, which have, you know, in some ways been, if not in all ways, been responsible for a lot of the violence and the refugee situation there. I saw a report just from yesterday, one day, where 6,500 refugees were picked up by the Italian Coast Guard in the Mediterranean. That's just in one day. Now, thousands have died drowning in the Mediterranean. So we have a big... How do you see the refugee problem developing?
Well, the problem there is this, as the climate changes and as we get these more extreme weather events, we find that the food, there's an international measure of average food prices called the food price index.
Yeah.
And that's gone up, went up to about 2.5 times what it had been in the 60s. In about 2010, it was just rising very rapidly. And it would pass, as it passed different levels, you started to get civil unrest, and the Arab Spring, to a big, great extent, was unemployed urban people not able to buy food because the food price index had driven it beyond the limits of their income. So there's a direct link between food production, food prices, and danger of unrest and warfare in the world, and that's a very serious problem.
Yeah, it certainly is. It's a very disturbing and saddening prospect as well for, you know, those thousands of people that are suffering. And it seems that sometimes that people just seem to think that climate change has kind of just started now because it's becoming more popular, as it were. It's been going on for decades, and there's been, you know, hundreds of thousands of people killed due to climate change and due to the effects of climate change, if not millions of people over 3 or 4 decades, I'm sure. Let's talk about methane for a minute. Methane clathrates and permafrost. Because I remember in our last interview we talked about this. And once again, this in your eyes would be a situation of get the geoengineering going quickly. But if it isn't, and the methane, I believe you've actually seen in the Arctic, like methane plumes. Is that correct? Yeah.
Yes, there's some pictures of this in the book, in fact.
Is there? Yeah, great.
there's a chapter about methane in the Arctic, and I think it's a very serious threat, which is one of those threats that's been underestimated by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. But the field, again, it's one of these things where field work has been done, has shown what's going on, but the results get ignored, especially by, as you said earlier, sometimes scientists themselves try to play down effects, especially climate modellers, whose models usually predict slow changes. But when you actually get fast changes, they don't want to know. And this particular methane one is the fact that offshore, along the Siberian coast, right way from the Bering Strait westwards to Norway, you have very shallow water, very wide continental shelves with water depths of only 50 to 100 meters. And in summer now, the sea ice retreats all the way off those shelves. You don't have to wait for the sea ice to disappear for it to have an impact. The fact that it's just come off the shelves is enough, because that gives you 3 or 4 months every year where you have ice-free conditions, shallow water. It's absorbing huge amounts of energy from solar radiation and warming up. And so measurements at the seabed have been finding temperatures up to 7 degrees. And that, of course, on the seabed, you've got a layer of permafrost, which is left over from the last ice age. The permafrost on land extends out to sea. So this subsea permafrost has been there since the ice age and has never melted, because right up until a few years ago, you still had sea ice in summer right to the coast. So the seawater never managed to warm up above zero, even in summer, but now it does. And that's causing the permafrost to melt. And below that, there's a big layer of sediments with which are actually full of methane hydrates, which is methane encapsulated in ice crystals. As soon as the layer of permafrost on top melts, it releases the pressure, and this comes out as huge plumes of methane. And again, scientists who don't work up there have said, well, that doesn't matter because the methane will dissolve in the water and that doesn't cause any problem. But in fact, the water depth's so shallow that the methane doesn't have time to dissolve. It just comes out and it's bubbles, and you have these huge bubble plumes more and more each year. And the groups that work there, which initially were Russian groups, but now you've had cruises by Swedish and Norwegian ships, and they find the same thing. So people are believing it now. Once the Swedes and the Norwegians measure it, people believe it's happening. When the Russians were measuring it, nobody believed it happened. But it does happen, and it's getting worse. And the potential thing is that you could get a huge sort of burp of methane from mm-hmm. all the sediment if the permafrost melts completely. And we modelled what would happen if we had 50 gigatons of methane released, and that will give you an immediate warming, a warming within about 5 years, of 0.6 of a degree. And 0.6 of a degree is a pretty substantial fraction of what we've had in the last 100 years, all delivered very, very rapidly. And so that will be extremely serious, and we should be taking that risk seriously and seeing what we can do about it rather than ignoring it and hoping it will go away, which is what the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change would like to do.
Yes, which I think on our last show or somewhere else, you called that wonderful panel criminally negligent, and I totally agree with you. And many people agree that the IPCC are being criminally negligent for various vested interest reasons. So there's also, of course, the large permafrost in Siberia, which is melting and creating these great kind of explosions, these great craters that you'll know about. How much of a concern is that?
Well, in fact, if you look in the IPCC assessments, they themselves recognise that in the long run, where the long run is only a few decades, there'll be a massive amount of methane released from the tundra. because the area of the tundra is so huge, the area covered by permafrost on land is gigantic. It's released much more slowly than this offshore methane because it has to be generated as well. The permafrost melts, you get a sort of soggy, rotted load of vegetation, which starts to rot some more, and it generates methane and carbon dioxide and a lot of other things. But methane's one of the products. So thawing permafrost will generate a lot of methane, and it's being generated more slowly than the offshore methane. But over a few decades, the total amount is as great. So when the IPCC says, well, it's kind of alarmist to say we'll have 50 gigatons of methane released from the offshore, they themselves, their own figures, show that by the end of the century, we'll have had 50 gigatons released from permafrost on land. So you either get a big dose straight away, which gives you a big boost to global warming, or you get the same dose more slowly, which of course gives you a big boost to global warming.
Right, so it's roughly the same time scale and the same amount. Well, it's the same amount, so that would, I presume, be another 0.6 degrees.
Yes, another 0.6. So it's methane is quite a very powerful greenhouse gas. The only thing that can save you, I suppose, is firstly, in about 7 to 10 years, it gets oxidized in the atmosphere. So carbon dioxide, when you release it into the atmosphere, it stays around for hundreds of years doing some horrible things to the climate system. But methane gets oxidized in 7 to 10 years. In fact, it gets turned into carbon dioxide.
Yeah.
If you get a big methane pulse, it will do a disastrous thing to the planet. But then if it's only a single pulse and doesn't continue to be emitted, then that will fade away. And
its half-life is what, seven years or something like that, is it? It's very potent to start off with,
then
but it still produces more carbon dioxide, which isn't going to be really that helpful.
But it's thought that there's a lot of mysteries of sudden climate changes that happened in the past with paleo climate studies.
Yeah.
Nobody knows what the cause was, but a possible one is some sudden release of methane from some feature or a volcanic eruption or something caused an instant big change to the climate, a big warming, and then it faded away and all the evidence disappeared. So nobody knows what caused that, but something did. And so there is a list of climate events in the past that where people are saying maybe we should finger methane as the villain.
Right. And I believe that we kind of had some kind of bizarre notion between us in our last conversation that we would have all these thousands of kind of rigs along the Siberian, along the area that you mentioned, sucking up the methane. Is there any kind of reality to that, or is that just a fantasy?
There's no reality to it because nothing's been done, but it has been proposed by an oil company, in fact. So it could be one way in which the oil industry can save the world is that you do essentially fracking underneath this sediment, and you pull out the methane by creating cavities, and then
of course nothing could go wrong there.
Well, I mean, it's a thing you do because you haven't got anything else you can do.
So you're not on the big cruise liner at the moment, then, going through the Northwest Passage, Peter.
Nobody's asked me to go on that.
Because that's getting quite a bit of criticism at the moment, from people that I know, from many people on Facebook and climate change groups. It's interesting that you're saying the methane is already underway in these shallow areas of coastline. And you've actually seen the evidence of this in huge plumes. You've got pictures of it in your book. I always find that the did you feel that there seems to be a people seem to be stuck on 2100, and that is the time scale, which it has been slowly but surely coming down in scientific journals and scientists and stuff, but you've mentioned it a couple of times yourself, 2100 by 2100. Do you think that, I think I've asked this before, but do you think this is just some kind of fantasy figure in the distance so people can kind of protect themselves from the reality?
Well, I think it's just that the most of the predictions in the IPCC assessments only go up to 2100 because they felt this is as far as we can go and still have some kind of accuracy in our predictions. But the trouble is, it's obviously they recognise warming goes on after that and maybe in an accelerated way, but other people don't, including we had a wonderful climate change secretary called Owen Paterson, and I quote a statement he made in my book where he said when he read the IPCC assessment in 2013, he said it was a great relief to see that we're only going to get about 2.5 degrees of warming, and half of it has already happened, and so that meant he thought that global warming would stop in 2100, and that half of it's happened, so we'll only get another half the same, and then everything will stop, everything will go flat. So that was his view of his understanding of IPCC climate change predictions. So.
Yes. Well, I'm not even going to bother talking to that. I mean, it's so ridiculous. I mean, the Blue Ocean event, I've seen a few new news articles recently about when this is likely to occur, involving involving you in the article. To me, it seems kind of almost irrelevant whether it's going to be this year, next year, the year after, or the year after. And it seems to be dwelling on an inconsequential, in to an extent that it's going to happen. Do you believe that a blue ocean event will definitely happen?
Oh yes, yes, I agree with you that
You should write a book called Farewell to Ice.
it's yes. Well, I do dwell on this a bit because I've been it's used quite a lot as a weapon to hit me with because my predictions were that the trend of sea ice volume in summer leads you down to zero about now. Now that doesn't mean it goes to zero now because there's annual fluctuations that sometimes are quite large. So it might be that it won't go down to zero for 2 or 3 years, but it will certainly go down to zero within, say, 5 years. And what I want to distinguish there was that between the predictions based on these observations, which are it will disappear in summer within 5 years, and the predictions which a lot of modelers still make that it won't disappear until the latter half of this century. And that's a very dangerous
That's
prediction.
crazy. That's crazy with the information we have. You just have to look at the satellite information. You just have to look at the observational information. It's just absolutely crazy to come out with stuff like that. That's criminally negligent.
Yes, but those predictions are made by organisations like the British Met Office and are used as policymakers in as advice to policymakers, and policymakers base policy on those sorts of assumptions. And so it is dangerous. But the main thing also is that you don't have to have the ice disappearing for the retreat of sea ice to cause problems. For instance, the retreat from the continental shelves is allowing already these methane plumes to form because that part of the Arctic Ocean is ice free. And the other thing that's causing sea level rise to accelerate is the fact that there's so much open water around in summer that it warms up the atmosphere, and the warmer air moves in over the Greenland ice sheet and causes surface melt on the Greenland ice sheet at a much greater rate than before. So that increases the rate of sea level rise because of water, meltwater coming off the Greenland ice sheet. So you don't, the ice doesn't have to disappear to start achieving all these feedback effects that are quite dangerous.
Yeah, and I mean, we're not just talking about Arctic ice here, are we? I mean, can you say something about how you anticipate the future of the Antarctic?
Well, at the moment, the Antarctic ice is holding out well. In fact, it's growing very slowly, and this is another mystery, because the Arctic ice is retreating much faster than climate models, which is why climate models get embarrassed by it. But the Antarctic ice is advancing when it should be retreating. There's one theory which I think might explain that, and which, again, I give in the book, but there's a lot of other possible theories, which is that we do know that the westerly winds around the Antarctic, the huge west winds in the Antarctic circumpolar ocean, are increased in intensity, and nobody really quite knows why, but they're faster. And when the wind is moving the ice flows eastwards, they're moving faster eastward than they were, but that they also get a northward component, because this Coriolis force that if you're moving along in anywhere in the world, if you're in the northern hemisphere, there's a force moving you to the right, and in the southern hemisphere, force moving to the left. So these ice flows are being pushed east by the wind, but they turn slightly north because of this force. And the faster they go, the further north the faster they move north. So the climate's warmer in the Antarctic on the whole now. The ice would like to melt. It would like to stay at a higher latitude, but because of this increased wind speed and the component that drives them northwards, the ice gets further north before it melts. So it's like being on a kind of a merry-go-round, and it's being thrown out to the northwards. It gets further north before it melts, even though the climate's warmer.
Right, and there is a distinction between the East Antarctic and the West Antarctic in terms of calving and such like. So there's maybe more of a melt happening in the West Antarctic.
Yes, there's a lot of links. That this is something that really is still not understood, which is that some sectors of the Antarctic are getting warmer and others are getting colder. And it seems that there's a links which are not quite understood between the Antarctic and the Arctic. There's certainly links between the Antarctic and the tropical Pacific. So when there's an El Nino, it affects the Antarctic. So there are parts of the Antarctic which are warming fast, like the ones where the ice shelves in the Weddell Sea are breaking up. But then there's the eastern part of the Antarctic is cooling.
Yeah. So it's a whole systematic thing, isn't it? And do you ever find that, you know, there's never enough research can be done, because sometimes the science and the is limited, our knowledge is limited regardless of the amount of research that is done, and that there may be things around the corner that we haven't anticipated?
Oh yes, I think that's the case. I mean, I do go into, in the chapter on the Antarctic ice, I go into what these links might be between the Antarctic ice and the tropical or the Arctic. But all the models that have been presented are very, very complicated. So because it's meant to be a popular book, I only go so far with that, and then I sort of give up and say, well, we still need to, more research is necessary.
Yeah, well, I don't know if this, we've covered quite a lot there, Peter. All I can say is thank you. Thank you very, very much for being with us on this very important day, which is the eve of the distribution of your, which I'm sure is a fantastic book.
Only £20.
And it's got pictures in it as well.
Coloured pictures.
That
yes.
We can look at. So I can't wait to read mine. And just what can I say, but thank you for giving us your time here on Extinction Radio today.
So it's a pleasure, and I hope the book has some impact. That's what
I'm sure it will, Peter. I'm sure it will. And let's hope it just has some impact out on the policymakers, on the IPCC. We shall see. But the more information that is out there, and I'm glad that you've found a way not to be restricted, and that you have the courage to put out a book like this. I have great respect for you in doing that. So thanks for that. And let's hope people just pick the thing up and read it and realize the extent of the predicament that we're in. Thank you, Peter. Thanks a lot. Thanks for being on Extinction Radio.
Well, pleasure.
Bye just now.
Bye.
Bye, Peter.